it's a tech that's not controlled by a small group of homogeneous people. I think that's pretty much it. I mean, and there's adequate regulation to allow for people to be safe and at the same time, not too much in order to be innovative and do things. You don't want the government deciding everything. It's a place where the internet, which was started by U.S. taxpayers, which was paid for, is beneficial for people and that there's transparency in it and that we can see what's happening and what's doing. And again, the concentration of power in the hands of a few people really is at the center of the problem.
That's Kara Swisher describing the balance she'd like to see in a better digital future. I'm Cindy Cohen, the Executive Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
And I'm Jason Kelly, EFF's Activism Director. You're listening to How to Fix the Internet.
This show is about envisioning a better digital future that we can all work towards.
And we're excited to have a guest who has been outspoken in talking about how we get there. She points out the good, the bad, and the ugly sides of the tech world.
Kara Swisher is one of the world's foremost tech journalists and critics. She's been covering the industry since the 1990s, and she currently hosts two podcasts, On with Kara Swisher and Pivot, and she's written several books, including last year's Burn Book, where she documents the history of Silicon Valley and the tech billionaires who run it. We're delighted that she's here. Welcome, Kara.
Thank you.
We've had a couple of tech critics on the podcast recently, and one of the kind of themes that's come up for us is you kind of have to love the internet before you can hate on it. And I've heard you describe your journey that way as well.
Yes.
And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about it because you didn't start off really, you know, kind of looking for all the way the things have gone wrong.
I don't hate it. I don't. It's just, you know, I have eyes and I can see, you know. I mean, one of the expressions I always use, you should believe what you see, not see what you believe. And so I always just, that's what's happening. You can see it happening. You can see the coarsening of our dialogue now offline, being affected by online. You could just see what's happened. But I still love the possibilities of technology and the promise of it. And I think that's what attracted me to it in the first place. And it's a question of how you use it as a tool or a weapon. And so I always look at it as a tool. And some people have taken a lot of these technologies and used them as a weapon.
Yeah. So what was that moment? Do you have a moment when you decided you were really interested in tech and that you really found it to be important and worth devoting your time to?
I was always interested in it because I had studied propaganda and the uses of TV and radio and stuff. So I was always interested in media. And this was the media on steroids. And so I recall downloading an entire book onto my computer and I thought, oh, look at this. Everything is digital. And so the premise that I came to at the time or the idea I came to was that everything that can be digitized would be digitized. And that was a huge idea because that means entire industries would change.
Yeah.
Kara, you started by talking about this concentration of power, which is obvious to anyone who's been paying attention. And at the same time, you know, we did used to have tech leaders who I think they had less power. It was less concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
But also, people were more focused, I think, on solving real problems. You know, you talk a lot about Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
There was a goal of improving people's lives with technology that didn't necessarily, it helped the bottom line, but the focus wasn't just on quarterly profits.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what you think it would look like if we returned to that in some way. Is that gone?
I don't think we were there. I think they were always focused on quarterly profits. I think that was a canard.
Really?
I wrote
okay.
about it, that they would pretend that they were here to help, you know, it's sort of like the Twilight Zone episode, To Serve Man. There, it's a cookbook. I always thought it was a cookbook for these people. And they were always formulated in terms of making money and maximizing value for their shareholders, which was usually themselves. I wasn't stupid. I understood what they were doing, especially when these stocks went to the moon, especially the early internet days and their first boom. And they became instantaires, I think they called that, which was instant millionaires, and then now beyond that. And so I was always aware of the money, even if they pretended they weren't. They were absolutely aware. And so I don't have a romantic version of this at the beginning, except among a small group of people who were seeing it like the Whole Earth Catalog and things like that, which were looking at it as a way to bring everybody together or to spread knowledge throughout the world, which I also believed in, too.
Do you think any of those people are still around?
No, they're dead.
I mean, literally, you know, they're literally dead. But is anyone, are there any heirs of theirs?
No, I mean, I don't think they had any power. I think that it was some of the theoretical stuff was about that. But no, they didn't have any power. The people that had power were the Mark Zuckerbergs, the Googles, and even, you know, the Microsofts. I mean, Bill Gates is kind of the exemplification of all that, as he took other people's ideas and he made it into an incredibly powerful company. And everybody else sort of followed suit.
So mostly for you, the concentration of power is the biggest shift that's happened. And you see regulation or, you know, anti-competitive moves as ways to get us back.
If we had any laws, that would be great. But we don't have any that constrain them. And now under President Trump, there's not going to be any rules around AI. Probably there aren't going to be any rules around any significant rules, at least, around any of it. So the first period, which was the growth of where we are now, was not constrained in any way. And now it's not just not constrained, but it's helping, whether it's cryptocurrency or things like that. And so I don't feel like there's any restrictions, like at this point. In fact, there's encouragement by government to do whatever you want.
Yeah, I think that's a really big worry. And, you know, I think you're aware, as are we, that, you know, just because somebody comes in and says they're going to do something about a problem with legislation doesn't mean that they're actually having that. And I think sometimes we feel like we sit in this space where we're like, we agree with you on the harm, but this thing you want to do is a terrible idea. And trying to get the means and the ends connected is kind of a lot of where we live sometimes. And I think you've seen that as well, that like once you've articulated the harm, that's kind of the start of the journey about whether the thing that you're talking about doing will actually meet that moment.
Absolutely. The harms they don't care about, that's the issue. And I think I was always cognizant of the harms. And that can make you seem like, you know, a killjoy of some sort, but it's not. It's just saying, wow, if you're going to do this social media, you better pay attention to this or that. Or they acted like regular problems that people had didn't exist in the world, like racism, you know, sexism. They said, oh, that can be fixed. And they never offered any solutions. And then they created tools that made it worse.
I feel like the people who thought that we could really use technology to build a better world, I don't think they were wrong or naive. I just think they got stomped on by the money. And, you know.
Which inevitably happens.
It does. And the question is, how do you squeeze out something, you know, given that this is the dynamic of capitalism, how do you squeeze out space for protecting people? And we've had times in our society when we've done that better and we've done that worse. And I feel like there are ways in which this is as bad as it's gotten in my lifetime, you know, with government actually coming in really strongly on the side of empowering the powerful and disempowering the disempowered. I see competition as a way to do this. EFF was, you know, it's primarily an organization focused on free speech and privacy, but we kind of backed into talking about competition because we felt like we couldn't get at any of those problems unless we talked about the elephant in the room. And I think you think about it, you know, really on the individual, you know all these guys, and on that very individual level of what kinds of things will impact them. And I'm wondering if you have some thoughts about the kinds of rules or regulations that might actually, you know, have an impact and not turn into, you know, yet another cudgel that they get to wield.
Well, I think any would be good. Like, there isn't any you could speak of that's really problematic for them, except for the courts, which are suing over antitrust issues or some regulatory agencies. But in general, what they've done is created a really easy glide path for themselves. I mean, we don't have a national privacy regulation. We don't have algorithmic transparency bills. We don't have data protection, really, and to speak of for people. We don't have, you know, transparency into the data they collect. You know, we have more rules and laws on airplanes and cigarettes and everybody else, but we don't have any here. So, you know, antitrust is a whole other area of changing of our antitrust rules. So these are all areas that have to be looked at, but they haven't passed a thing. I mean, lots of legislators have tried, but it hasn't worked, really.
You know, a lot of our supporters are people who work in tech, but aren't necessarily the, you know, the tech giants. They're not the tops of these companies, but they work in the companies. And one of the things that I, you know, I don't know if you have any insights, if you've thought about this, but we speak with them a lot and they're dismayed at what's going on, but they kind of feel powerless. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts like, you know, speaking to the people who aren't the Elons and the guys at the top, but who are there and who I think are critical to keeping these companies going. Are there ways that they can make their voices heard that you've thought of that might work? I guess I'm pulling on your insight because you know the actual people.
Yeah, speak out. You know, everybody gets a voice these days, and there's all kinds of voices that never would have gotten heard. And to, you know, talk to legislators, involve customers, create businesses where you do those good practices. Like, that's the best way to do it, is create wealth and capitalism and then use best practices there. That, to me, is the best way to do that.
Are there any companies that you look at from where you sit that you think are doing a pretty good job or at least trying? I don't know if you want to call anybody out, but, you know, we see a few and I kind of feel like all the air gets sucked out of the room.
Yeah, I mean, in bits and pieces, you know, Apple's good on the privacy thing, but then it's bad on a bunch of other things. Like the problem is, you know, these are shareholder driven companies. And so they're going to do what's best for them, and they could, you know, wave over to privacy or wave over to, you know, more diversity, but they really are interested in making money. And so I think the difficulty is figuring out, you know, do they have duties as citizens or do they just have duties as corporate citizens? And so that's always been a difficult thing in our society and will continue to be.
Yeah.
We've always at EFF really stood up for the user in this way, where sometimes we're praising a company that normally people are upset with because they did a good thing, right? Apple is good on privacy. When they do good privacy things, we say, that's great. You know, and if Apple makes mistakes, we say that too. And it feels like, you know, we're in the middle of, I guess, a tech lash. I don't know when it started. I don't know if it'll ever end. I don't know if that's even a real term in terms of, like, you know, tech journalism. But do you find that it's difficult to get people to accept sort of like any positive praise for companies that are often just at this point completely easy to ridicule for all the mistakes they've made?
I think the tech journalism has gotten really strong. It's gotten, I mean, just look at the Doge coverage. I think it really, I'll point to Wired as a good example, as they've done astonishing stuff. I think a lot of people have done a lot on the abuses of social media. I think they've covered a lot of issues from the overuse of technology to, you know, all these crypto stuff. It doesn't mean people follow along, but they've certainly been there and revealed a lot of the flaws there. While also covering it as like, this is what's happening with AI. Like, this is what's happening. Here's where it's going. And so you have to cover it as a thing, like, this is what's being developed. But then there's others, you know, who have to look into the real problems.
I get a lot of news from 404. Media, right?
They're great.
That sort of model is relatively new and it sort of sits against some of these legacy models.
Sure.
Do you see like a growing role for things like that in a future?
I there's lots of different things. I mean, I came from legacy. I mean, it's a part of the time, although I got away from it pretty quickly, but some of them are doing great. It just depends on the story, right? Some of the stories are great. Like, there's a ton of people at the Times who've done great stuff on lots of things around kids and abuses and social media. At the same time, there's all these really exciting independent media companies, whether it's Casey Newton, a platformer, or Eric Newcomer covering VCs, or 404. There's all these really interesting new stuff that's doing really well. Wired is another one that's really seen a lot of bounce back under its current editor, who just came on relatively recently. So it just depends. It depends on where it is. But there's Verge does a great job. But I think it's individually, the stories. There's no like big name in this area. There's just a lot of people. And then there's all these really interesting experts or people who work in tech who've written a lot. That is always very interesting to me. It's interesting to hear from insiders what they think is happening.
Well, I'm happy to hear this optimism, because I worry a lot about, you know, the way that the business model for media has really been hollowed out, and then seeing things like some of the big broadcast news people folding.
But broadcast never did journalism from tech. Come on, like, give me a break. Some did. I mean, one or two, but it wasn't them who was doing it. It was usually, you know, either the New York Times or these smaller institutions have been doing a great job. There's just been tons and tons of different things, completely different things.
What do you think about the fear? Maybe I'm misplacing it. Maybe it's not as real as I imagine it is, that results from something like a Gawker situation, right? You know, you have wealthy people.
Well, that was a long time ago.
It was, but it, you know, a precedent was sort of set, right? I mean, do you think people in working in tech journalism can take aim at, you know, individual people that have a lot of power and wealth in the same way that they could before?
Yeah, I think they can if they're accurate. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think you're a good exhibit A for that. You pull no punches and things are okay. I mean, we get asked sometimes, are you ever under attack because of your sharp advocacy? And I kind of think your sharp advocacy protects you as long as you're right. And I think of you as somebody who's also in a bit of that position.
Mm-hmm.
You may say this is inevitable, but I wanted to ask you, you know, I feel like when I talk with young technical people, they've kind of been poisoned by this idea that the only way you can be successful is if you're an asshole, mm-hmm. That there's no, yeah. there's no model, mm-hmm. that just goes to the deal. So if they want to be successful, they mm-hmm. have to be just an awful person. And so even if they might've thought differently beforehand, that's what they think they have to do. And I'm wondering if you run into this as well. And I sometimes find myself trying to think about, you know, alternate role models for technical people. And if you have any that you think of.
Alternate role models? It's mostly men. But there's all kinds of, like, I just did an interview with Lisa Su, who's head of AMD,
mm-hmm.
One of the few women CEOs. In AI, there's a number of women. But, you know, you don't necessarily have to have diversity to make it better, but it sure helps, right? Because people have a different, not just diversity of gender or diversity of race, but diversity of background, of politics. You know, the more diverse you are, the better products you make, essentially. That's always been my feeling. Look, most of these companies are the same as it ever was. And in fact, there's fewer different people running them, essentially. But, you know, that's always been the nature of tech, essentially, that it was sort of a man's world.
Yeah, I see that as well. I just worry that young people or junior people coming up think that the only way that you can be successful is, A, if you look like the guys who are already successful, but also, you know, if you're just kind of not, you know, if you're weird and not nice.
It's just, it depends on the person. It's just that when you get that wealthy, you have a lot of people licking you up and down all day. And so you end up in the crazies zone like Elon Musk or the arrogant zone like Mark Zuckerberg or whatever. It's just they don't get a lot of pushback. And when you don't get a lot of friction, you tend to think everything you do is correct.
Let's take a quick moment to thank our sponsor. How to Fix the Internet is supported by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation's Program in Public Understanding of Science and Technology, enriching people's lives through a keener appreciation of our increasingly technological world and portraying the complex humanity of scientists, engineers, and mathematicians. We also want to thank our EFF donors. You're the reason that we exist, and EFF has been fighting for digital rights now for 35 years, and that fight is bigger than ever. So please, if you like what we do, go to EFF.org/pod to donate. And also, if you can't make it in person to this year's EFF Awards, where we celebrate the people working towards the better digital future that we all care so much about, you can watch the whole event at EFF.org/awards. We also wanted to share that our friend Cory Doctorow has a new podcast. Have a listen to this.
How did the internet go from this?
You could actually find what you were looking for right away, bang,
to this.
I feel like I'm in hell.
Spoiler alert, it was not an accident. I'm Cory Doctorow, host of Who Broke the Internet from CBC's Understood. In this four-part series, I'm going to tell you why the internet sucks now, whose fault it is, and my plan to fix it. Find Who Broke the Internet on whatever terrible app you get your podcasts.
And now back to our conversation with Kara Swisher.
I mean, you watched all these tech giants kind of move over to the Trump side and then, you know, stand there on the inauguration. It sounds like you thought that might have been inevitable.
I said it was inevitable. Like, everyone was surprised. They're always surprised when they're like, Elon's going to crack up with the president. Oh, look, they cracked up. It's not hard to follow these people.
Yeah.
In his case, he's personally, there's something wrong with his head, obviously. He always cracks up with people. So that's what happened here. In that case, they just wanted things. They want things. I think they like Donald Trump. You're wrong there. I'll tell you. They don't like him. They need him. They want to use him. And they were irritated by Biden because he presumed to push back on them. And he didn't do a very good job of it, honestly. But they definitely want things.
I think the tech industry came up at a time when deregulation was all the rage, right? So in some ways, they were kind of born into a world where regulation was an anathema, and they took full advantage of the situation. You know, as did lots of other areas that got deregulated or were not regulated in the first place. But I think tech, that because of timing in some ways, tech was really born into this zone. And there were some good things for it, too. I mean, you know, EFF was successful in the 90s in making sure that the internet got First Amendment protection, that we didn't go to the other side with things like the Communications Decency Act and squelch any adult material from being put online and reduce everything to the side. But getting that right and kind of walking through the middle ground where you have regulation that supports people but doesn't squelch them is just an ongoing struggle, I think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I have this optimistic hope that these companies and their owners sort of crumble as they continue to, as Cory Doctorow says, in shitify, right? The only reason they don't crumble is that they have this lock-in with users, they have this monopoly power. But you see a TikTok pops up and suddenly Instagram has a real competitor, not because rules have been put in place to change Instagram, but because a different, new, maybe better platform.
Well, there's nothing like competition making things better, right? Competition always helps.
When I think of competition law, I think of crushing companies. I think of breaking them up. But what do you think we can do to make the sort of world better and more fertile for new companies? You know, you talked earlier about tech workers.
Well, you have to pass those things where they don't get to... Antitrust is the best way to do that, right? But those things move really slowly, unfortunately. Yeah. And, you know, good antitrust legislation and antitrust enforcement... that's happening right now, but it opens up. I mean, the reason Google exists is because of the antitrust actions around Microsoft. And so we have to continue to press on things like that and continue to have regulators that are allowed to pursue cases like that. And then at the same time, have a real focus on creating wealth. We want to create wealth. We want to give people breaks. We want to have the government involved in funding some of these things, making it so that small companies don't get run over by larger companies, not letting power concentrate into a small group of people. When that happens, that's what happens. You end up with less companies. They kill them in the crib, these companies. Yeah. And so not letting things get bought, have a scrutiny over things, stuff like that.
Yeah, I think a lot more merger review makes a lot of sense. I think a lot of thinking about how are companies crushing each other and where are the things that we can do to try to stop that. Obviously, we care a lot about interoperability, making sure that technologies that have you as a customer don't get to lock you in and make it so that you're just stuck with their broken business model and can do other things. There's a lot of space for that kind of thing. I mean, you know, I always tell the story, I'm sure you know this, that, you know, if it weren't for the FCC telling AT&T that they had to let people plug something other than phones into the wall, we wouldn't have had the internet, you know, the home internet revolution anyway.
Right. Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. So, I think we are in agreement with you that, you know, competition is really central, but it's, you know, it's kind of an all of the above, and certainly around privacy issues, we can do a lot around this business model, which I think is driving so many of the other bad things that we are seeing with some comprehensive privacy law. But boy, it sure feels like right now, you know, we got two branches of government that are not on board with that. And the third one kind of doing okay, but not, you know, but in the courts were doing okay, but slowly and inconsistently. Mm-hmm. Where do you see hope? Where are you looking for good stuff?
I mean, some of this stuff around AI could be really great for humanity, or it could be great for a small amount of people. That's really, yeah, which one do we want? Do we want this technology to be a tool or a weapon against us? Do we want it to be in the hands of bigger companies or in the hands of all of us, and we make decisions around it? Will it help us be safer? Will it help us cure cancer? Or is it going to just make a rich person $1 billion richer?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the age-old story, isn't it? This is not a new theme in America where the rich get richer and the poor get less. And so these technologies could, as you know, recently I was looking at a book called Abundance. It could create lots of abundance. It could create lots of interesting new jobs. Or it could just put people out of work and let the people who are richer get richer. And I don't think that's a society we want to have. And years ago, I was talking about income inequality with a really wealthy person. And I said, you either have to do something about, you know, the fact that people, that we didn't have a $25 minimum wage, which I think would help a lot. Lots of innovation would come from that. If people made more money, they'd have more choices. And it's worth the investment in people to do that. And I said, we have to either deal with income inequality or armor plate your Tesla. And I think he wanted to armor plate his Tesla. That's what I read. And then, of course, Cybertruck comes out. So there you have it. But I think they don't care about that kind of stuff. You know, they're happy to create their little, those little worlds where they're highly protected. But it's not a world I want to live in.
Kara, thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming in. I think you sit in such a different place in the world than where we sit. And it's always great to get, you know, your perspective.
Absolutely. Anytime. You guys do amazing work. And, you know, you're doing amazing work. And you should always keep a watch on these people. It's not, you shouldn't be against everything, because some people are, right? But you certainly should keep a watch on people.
We'll keep it up. Yeah, we'll keep doing it. Thank you, Kara.
All right. Thank you so much.
Well, I always appreciate how Kara gets right to the point about how the concentration of power among a few tech moguls has led to so many of the problems we face online, and how competition, along with some things we so often hear about, real laws requiring transparency, privacy protections, and data protections, can help shift the tide.
Yeah, you know, some of these fixes are things that people have been talking about for a long time, and I think we're at a point where everyone agrees on a big chunk of them, you know, especially the ones that we promote, like competition and transparency oftentimes and privacy. So it's great to hear that Kara, who's someone that, you know, has worked on this issue in tech for a long time and thought about it and loves it, as she said, you know, agrees with us on some of the most important solutions.
Sometimes these criticisms of the tech moguls can feel like something everybody does, but I think it's important to remember that Kara was really one of the first ones to start pointing this out. And I also agree with you. You know, she's a person who comes from the position of really loving tech. And Kara's even a very strong capitalist. She really loves making money as well. You know, her criticism comes from a place of betrayal that, again, like Molly White earlier this season, kind of comes from a position of, you know, seeing the possibilities and loving the possibilities and then seeing how horribly things are really going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, she has this framing of, is it a tool or a weapon? And it feels like a lot of the tools that she loved became weapons, which I think is how a lot of us feel. You know, it's not always clear when you like how to draw that line. But it's obviously a good question that people, you know, working in the tech field, and I think people even using technology should ask themselves when you're really enmeshed with it, is the thing you're using or building or promoting, is it working for everyone? You know, what are the chances? How could it become a weapon? You know, this beautiful tool that you're loving and you have all these good ideas and, you know, ideas that it'll change the world and improve it. There's always a way that it can become a weapon. So I think it's an important question to ask and an important question that people, you know, working in the field need to ask.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's the gem of her advice to tech workers, you know, find a way to make your voice heard if you see this happening. And there's a power in that. I do think that one thing that's still true in Silicon Valley is they compete for top talent. And, you know, top talent indicating that they're going to make choices based on some values is one of the levers of power. Now, I don't think anybody thinks that's the only one. This isn't an individual responsibility question. We need laws. We need structures. You know, we need some structural changes in antitrust law and elsewhere in order to make that happen. It's not all on the shoulders of the tech workers. But I appreciate that she really did say, you know, there's a role to be played here. You're not just pawns in this game.
And that's our episode for today. Thanks so much for joining us. If you have feedback or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Visit EFF.org/podcast and click on listener feedback. And while you're there, you can become a member and donate, maybe even pick up some of the merch, and just see what's happening in digital rights this week and every week. Our theme music is by Nat Keefe of Beatmower with Reed Mathis, and How to Fix the Internet is supported by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation's Program in Public Understanding of Science and Technology. We'll see you next time. I'm Jason Kelly.
And I'm Cindy Cohen.
This podcast is licensed Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International and includes the following music licensed Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, unported by its creators. Drops of H2O, The Filtered Water Treatment by Jay Lang. Additional music, theme remixes, and sound design by Gaetan Harris.